Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
My God is good to me.
Yeah.
My God is good to me.
Yeah.
My God is good to me.
Oh, yeah.
Ain't he good to you?
Yeah.
Ain't he good to you?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new documentary, Rejoice and Shout, tells the remarkable story of the rise of gospel music, its origins, its heroes and innovators, its meaning to a people who had known slavery and found grace and freedom in song. We all know the outlines of that story, but the historical details and the old school music are powerful. This hour on Point, the roots of gospel music. You can join the conversation. Does gospel music speak to you in the year 2011? What does it say? Can you hear its sound and energy behind a broader stand of American popular music? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Dixie Hummingbirds behind me right there, performing at Newport in 1966, but this music goes way back, and the new documentary really shows that early history. Joining me now from Sag Harbor, New York, is Joe Lauro, music and film archivist and producer of the new documentary, Rejoice and Shout. It opens this Friday in theaters nationwide. You can get a link to where it's playing at our website, onpointradio.org. Joe, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. And man, did you dig into some wonderful archives to bring out this sound and the film footage as well. It is really something. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you very much. It was truly one of those long-winded labor of loves, but we kept our eyes on the prize, as they say.
I can see there's a lot of work behind it. Also with us this hour from Washington, D.C., is gospel historian Bill Carpenter. He's the author of Uncloudy Days, the Gospel Music Encyclopedia. Bill Carpenter, welcome. Great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. You make a big mark in this documentary with your observations on gospel music, and we just want to hear a lot of it in this hour. In addition to getting those insights, we've pulled a little bit of some shorter clips out of the documentary, Joe and Bill. The first one I want to play right here because it's from so early on. It's 1902. This is the Dinwiddie Colored Quartet. Joe Lauro, we're going to listen here. We've just got 15 seconds of it, but tell us about this. Who are these guys, and where did they come from?
Well, I could tell you about the recording. We acquire archival recordings, blues, jazz, gospel, and this is of the. I would not say it is the first known recording, but it is one of the absolute earliest. It was recorded by Victor Records, which is now Bertelsen Group,
right.
Back in a piece of shellac.
Before RCA Victor, before Bertelsen, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
And what can you tell us, Bill, about the Dinwiddie Quartet? Colored quartet,
well,
as it were.
It was a quartet that came together to actually raise money for a normal school around 1902, and that was their strict purpose for existing, was to go around and sing jubilee songs and raise money to send kids to school.
A normal school, and, as in a school to train teachers?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were only together about a couple of years, and they recorded, I think, about maybe 6 to 8 sides.
That's right.
Maybe Joe knows better, but
8 sides.
Songs like Campground and the song you just heard.
Well, let's hear this one right here. This is 1902. Talk about going back. Of course, gospel goes back much further. We'll talk about it. But here's the Dinwiddie Colored Quartet singing Gabriel's Trumpet. We've just got 15 seconds.
Yonder dressed in blue,
glory to the Lamb.
Must be the children that just come through,
glory to the Lamb.
And who's that yonder dressed in white,
glory to the Lamb.
Must be the children that saw the light,
glory to the Lamb.
The Dinwiddie right there, quartet. And let's jump right ahead. That's 02. Let's go to 22. Here's the Utica Quartet singing Deep River, recording from 1922.
My home is where the joy.
Arabica Quartet 1922. Bill Carpenter, help us understand the sound of these two examples of gospel music. You've got all kinds, many flavors, and a lot that's much more rambunctious than these two. There's a kind of sweetness there. Is that because they were four recordings and that's what the recording companies wanted, or what?
Well, what it was is back in that time period, they sang Jubilee music is considered sort of formal, polished kind of music, mm-hmm. barbershop quartet type of music. And it was later that people like Thomas Dorsey put blues into gospel, and then like the Dixie Hummingbirds brought the frenetic, you know, the frenzied, energized type of gospel we associate with gospel. But the earliest gospel was meant to appeal to a wide audience, again, like the Dinwiddie Color Quartet, which was based in Dinwiddie, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
They were performing on minstrel shows and programs like that to a mixed audience. And the music that was popular was the barbershop quartet type of style, and that's why it was formal, clean, smooth music like what you just heard there.
Now,
in fact,
a
little bit later, mm-hmm. when the record companies realized there was money to be made selling phonograph records to African Americans, mm-hmm. And they had what was known as race records, which were records specifically made for the African American market.
Wow.
That's when the stuff started getting a little bit wilder, because you know, they were preaching to the choir then, as they say, and they weren't trying to sell specifically to a wider mixed crowd. They were able to be more specific, and you know, the sanctified material started getting recorded.
You might say ecstatic. We'll hear some of that, but a little more of this first, because this old school is so fascinating to hear. There's one, and tell us about this, Joe. It's obviously from the archives. We've got the Norfolk Jubilee Quartet, and they're sitting on a gigantic mound of shucked oyster shells.
Yeah,
what's
right.
up with that setting?
Well, they were from Virginia. They were working as oyster shuckers at the time. And when this was filmed in 1927,
mm-hmm.
the sound camera was absolutely in its infancy. And Fox, who filmed it, had one camera. So when they filmed this thing, they'd have them sing it once in a long shot, once in a close-up, once in a middle shot. And we had to edit the stuff together. But, you know, they simply were there working. And it's sort of like work songs. And, you know, and that's where they – and these people were very famous on phonograph records. They recorded from as early as 1921 and went on into the late 30s.
So it wasn't just a set – I mean, they were actually still shucking oysters while they sang this amazing music that was still their job? Or was this just for atmosphere?
That particular day, Fox Movietone visited an oyster shucking plant where people, as they were shucking oysters — we didn't see that in the film, we couldn't find the place for it — they're actually singing work songs. It's the most remarkable, because it isn't like Alan Lomax going there and looking for it. It was just happening.
Wow.
And they filmed it. And then after that part, they went to this big pile of oysters, and they got the Jubilee guys who were working there to assemble themselves and sing "Do You Call That Religion?"
Let's hear it. I mean, picture them. There's four of them sitting on a huge mound, much bigger than them, of oyster shells, very straight-faced, and with this gospel music.
Do you call that religion?
No, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
No,
no.
Church.
I know a brother in my church who's got
the Norfolk Jubilee
right
Quartet. Bill Carpenter would begin to hear a little bit of the African roots there in that call and response right there. It's already 1928. I mean, you know, this population's been on this continent for a long time by then. But you can hear the old, old, old call and response still at work in 1927, 28 there, Bill.
Exactly. I think that's what makes gospel music, is that it's a fusion. It's a fusion of the European hymn tradition along with the congas and the other natural elements of African music, and they put all that together and created this sound. Because like the earlier music we were listening to, I wouldn't say that was derivative of African music.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the European style.
Right.
But like right here, you're hearing people beginning to put that I don't even know if this is tied to the Azusa Street, where, which was really, I would say, the really real beginning of the characteristic gospel music, the energetic, the frenzied, the ecstatic sound.
We're going to come back and hear much more of that. We're talking today about the roots and history of gospel music. New documentary headed out, and it's really terrific, full of beautiful, amazing archival footage and music. It's called Rejoice and Shout. Its producer, Joe Lauro, is with us today, joins us from Sag Harbor, New York. And from Washington, Bill Carpenter is here, author of Uncloudy Days, the Gospel Music Encyclopedia. He's all over the film and with us right here. We're going to learn a lot more. Thomas A. Dorsey and much more. Here's Mahalia Jackson singing his Take My Hand, Precious Lord. Listeners, you can join us. Did you grow up with gospel? Are you singing it now? And how do you understand where it came from, what it meant, what it means today? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the roots and story of gospel music and the new documentary that pulls it all together. It's called Rejoice and Shout. Joe Lauro, producer of the film, is with us today, as is Bill Carpenter, author of Uncloudy Days, the Gospel Music Encyclopedia. You can join the conversation. Do you still listen to the old school gospel voices? Mahalia Jackson, Rosetta Tharpe right here behind us, the Dixie Hummingbirds. African-American listeners, was this the sound of your Sunday morning? Is it still? And can you hear how this music infused nearly all American popular music, or so much of it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Rosetta Tharpe behind us right there. Bill Carpenter, by the time we get to Rosetta Tharpe, things are really cooking here. This was one bold singer, and she plays her own guitar.
That was controversial because most women did not play guitar then, certainly not in public. And she also performed at the Cotton Club and sang with Lucky Millinder's band. And she did all kinds of things church folks just weren't supposed to do. So she was a trailblazer. And as a trailblazer, she was heralded by many, but also scorned by many others. So she certainly set the way for, like, if you want to jump to now, people like Kirk Franklin and Mary Mary, who periodically cross over to the pop charts with their music.
You can hear that crossover potential all over this music. Let's talk about Thomas A. Dorsey. This is not Tommy Dorsey. This is Thomas A. Dorsey, who was a kind of gospel music writing mogul of his time. He wrote lots and lots and lots of songs, including Take My Hand, Precious Lord. He also sort of worked both sides of the fence, the church and the secular side in the nightclubs, Bill.
He got his start with Ma Rainey as her piano player. You know, of course, she was the great blues singer. And he really brought that blues style to gospel because, as we mentioned before, it was still a Jubilee formal type of music. And he started to put chords in there that people just weren't used to hearing in gospel music. And again, he was also beat up on and called a devil for bringing these ungodly sounds into the church. But, you know, now we look back at this and it seems tame. But mm-hmm. at the time, it was very revolutionary.
There's a lot in the film about how the evolution took place and how it moved. Ira Tucker is in the Dixie Hummingbirds. He was the youngest one to join, joined at 13 in 1937. And in the documentary Rejoice and Shout, he talks about what it was like traveling and playing this music, especially in the South, back in the 1930s.
It was kind of rough coming up, getting started, because it was pretty bad, you know, especially in the South. But we just kept going. Time we were locked up, even shot at.
To Ira Tucker, the wonderful Ira Tucker from the Dixie Hummingbirds. Now, Bill Carpenter, was it traveling from church to church to church, or was it church, church, club, church, if you were the Dixie Hummingbirds?
Well, it was the Dixie Hummingbirds and Sister Rosetta Tharpe were one of the few who actually got to perform in nightclubs or something like that. But basically, it was a gospel caravan. You just jump in a car, station wagon with your band and your singers, and you go city to city. You stay at other black people's homes because there were no hotels open to you. And you just sing, and they take up an offering. If you sing really good, they start throwing money at the stage. Mm-hmm. And that's how you made it. And they would do that from the East Coast to the West Coast and then reverse the trip.
But the heart of this music in Joe Laurel, we see it in your footage, and again, it's quite incredible, was in black churches and all kinds of black churches, very often Pentecostal churches, where people would, you'd have the music and you'd have call and response going on, you'd have prayer and you'd have people speaking in tongues, you'd have people going, you know, into the arms of their fellow parishioners or to the floor in ecstasy. You've got some amazing black and white footage here. This is King Louis, is it Narcisse? At the Mount Zion Spiritual Temple. This is in California, I think Oakland, California. And let's listen to a little bit as he's, you can hear the sort of musical sound of this. He's speaking from the pulpit, and it is near mayhem at this meeting, but it is a mayhem of the spirit, of kind of ecstatic. There's a woman rolling on the floor in religious ecstasy. Here it is.
And then I thank God for bread on the table today.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And for water. Water to drink. On the sick. Breathe on the afflicted. Breathe. Breathe on us, Lord.
Breathe on us all, and hear one parishioner who is deep in the hold of that moment. Bill Carpenter, talk about this spot, this sort of a holy intersection here between the music, the church life, its background, and this as a kind of doorway to transcendence or ecstasy or even a pained ecstasy you might hear there.
Exactly. Well, I think that as an African American myself, they experience things that I have never known or experienced.
So when you say you can they, imagine, you mean people at that time in these settings, are you saying?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been relatively pampered compared to these people.
Oh, you mean in terms of the lives they led outside
exactly.
the church doors, yes?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. These are people who had nothing. So when they talk about there was food on my table and things like that, there was no welfare system. There was no food stamp program. If they did not work, if wherever they were living, if they were not taken care of, then they just died. And so when they talk about bread on the table and I woke up this morning, they really mean it. They're not just talking figuratively. You know, because a lot of people who worked on plantations, if they got sick, they just died. You know, there was no hospital for them. If you got old, you were no longer useful because they need the strength of the youth to carry on the duties of the plantation. So all they had was their belief in a world after this world and this God who would bring them through. So that's the ecstasy you're hearing. That's their lover, is that God, because everything around them is miserable. So looking to him creates this euphoria. And that's why I say it's something I can't totally I can appreciate it, you know, philosophically, but I've never been in that position.
Do you feel jealous when you see it in this amazing archival footage, or are you glad you never knew the circumstances that drove them?
I'm actually glad I never knew the circumstances, mm-hmm. but I'm glad to know the history because I think it's important to know just how, you know, and there are other ethnic groups in this country who have experienced this. You know, the people from Eastern Europe, when they came to Chicago and places like that and had to work in the meatpacking factories. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, every group has had a story, and this is the story of many African Americans who were born in this country. You come from nothing, and then when you're thrown off the plantation and you have to fend for yourself and find a job, and no one wants to hire you because you're black, and the only jobs open are you can be a maid or a porter or a longshoreman. Those words really mean a lot when they say, he was there for me, when God was there for me.
Joe Laurel, you're one of the country's greatest collectors of this kind of old archival footage. You've described what you see in the gospel music archives as a kind of alternate universe. I mean, what were you thinking as you went through and saw these scenes of euphoria, of ecstasy, of sometimes frenzy, Joe? How did it strike you as you really began to focus on these?
Well, my main point was really to show the glory of this music and some of the amazing artists that perform in it. And what I really meant by a parallel universe is that these artists existed in a world of people that loved and followed gospel music, and it was not the mainstream, not like blues, not like jazz, but closely related, except for the message. And you know, the message in 300 years never changed. The rhythms might have changed. The way it was expressed might have changed. But the message was, you know, praising the Lord, you know, and the power that it brings to you. And, you know, I kind of knew what to expect, but there were always surprises when we were filming. The opening shot of the little Selby girl singing Amazing Grace was completely unplanned. I was talking to them, because what we tried to do in the film is basically show that while, again, the music has changed, the message hasn't, but I wanted to say, hey, look, you know, do you use any of the old hymns or the old songs in the work that you're doing now? Because the Selvies are a contemporary group.
In Memphis, terrific, yeah.
Yeah, and they looked at each other, and this little girl just started singing Amazing Grace.
It's a very, very beautiful moment in the film, and boy, does she go with it. But you talk about the glory. You've got a very early appearance by Mahalia Jackson, the great Mahalia Jackson, on The Ed Sullivan Show, 1951. Talk about power and glory in a voice. She famously had it. Let's listen. These Are They. And here it is, Mahalia Jackson, 1951, television, The Ed Sullivan Show.
And it was all.
Carpenter, talk about a great, and you can hear so much music that came after 1951 in that as well. I can think of so many performers, white, black, and you name it, with that kind of rhythm, but very few, maybe none, with that kind of voice. And this was Mahalia Jackson had, what, born in New Orleans, headed for Chicago, a hairdresser. How did she come to know her own voice? Was it in the church? Had to be.
Well, actually, her musical influences were Bessie Smith. And she actually wanted to sing like Bessie Smith, but because of her family's faith, mm-hmm. and them telling her that it was wrong, she didn't do that. But she would listen to Bessie Smith records and try to emulate her. So I would say she took that along with her Baptist upbringing and created her own style that is still influencing people such as Aretha Franklin and all sorts of people who came after her.
No kidding. Here's Mavis Staples talking about the first time she heard Mahalia Jackson. She was 6 or 7 years old. And here's, we'll try and go to Mavis Staples here.
Yonder come a little David,
said I,
with his rock and sling,
said I,
I don't want to meet him,
said I,
he's a dangerous man,
said I'll serve him and rest a while.
Mabel Staples, I guess the song speaks for itself right there. Let's go to Wallace calling from Nashville, Tennessee. We've got a lot of listeners lined up here. Wallace, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for doing this subject, man. I tell you, you do a great job in the variety of subjects. I'm just always surprised each morning I listen to you.
I'm happy for that, Wallace. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, my background is ministry, and I've been preaching for about 30 years, and my background religiously is Church of Christ, and mm-hmm. we sing every Sunday a cappella, which means, of course, without instrument.
Sure.
And I was wondering, guys, when did instruments come into play? It's like in, I guess, late 1800s, early 1900s, there was no mechanical instrumental music, whether it was church or mm-hmm. or out in the cotton fields. I'm talking about, when did that come into play?
I mean, it's an interesting question in part because, as you know well, Wallace, but watching the archival footage here, you really have to define what an instrument is because, you know, a hand on the thigh, there's a lot of that, a shovel being swung or a pick and some of those chain gangs, sadly. But the, you know, there's accompaniment. But what about it, Bill Carpenter? What, you know, the move from voice alone to voice with instrument, what and when?
Well, it's probably around the time of Thomas Dorsey. I'm not going to say that he was the first to introduce the piano, but he's one of the first to really popularize it because the way Thomas Dorsey got his music distributed was he and Sally Martin and Mahalia Jackson would tour the country at churches and introduce the songs he wrote. Later, in the 50s, drums began to come. With the Mighty Clouds of Joy, groups like that started to bring in the drums and guitars. So really the 50s for the real percussion instruments, but I would say the 30s for the piano and organ.
And earlier in the 20s, there are recordings and actual film footage that we have with banjo accompaniment.
Banjo in the film footage, and surely that would go way back. But it hardly needed accompaniment to be amazingly moving, and we can see that in the footage from the new documentary "Rejoice and Shout," and it is quite something to see. Wallace, we're happy to hear from you in Nashville today. We'll come back and take more calls here with this great strand of music. Of course, it ultimately moved deep into the mainstream of American music as well. Once in a while, right up on the top 40 charts. Oh, happy day. This was the Edwin Hawkins Singers. This is live from 1971, went right on to the pop charts. We're talking about the roots and story of gospel music with Joe Lauro, producer of Rejoice and Shout. Bill Carpenter is with us, author of Uncloudy Days. Listeners, you can join us. What's your history with gospel music? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Recession. Yeah.
depression and unemployment. This song's for you.
Today's a new day, but there is no sunshine. Nothing but clouds, and it's dark in my heart. And it feels
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the roots and story of gospel music today in the new documentary that puts it all together. It's called Rejoice and Shout. This song behind us right now from Kirk Franklin jumps right out of that history. It's totally contemporary. I Smile, it's called. It's number one on the Billboard charts for gospel this week. And you can hear all the very contemporary influence in there working both ways. Kirk Franklin's I Smile. Harkening back and yet pushing forward as well. Listeners, you can join us this hour. What is the key to the freedom of gospel music, the joy of it? And is gospel hanging in there, or is it giving way? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joe Lauro, producer of the new documentary Rejoice and Shout, is with us. You can find a list of where it will be appearing in select theaters around the country. Starts this Friday nationwide. Joe is president of Historic Films' big stock footage archive of all kinds of wonderful archival materials. Bill Carpenter is with us as well, author of Uncloudy Days, the Gospel Music Encyclopedia. And there was the very contemporary gospel behind us. We'll talk about it. Let me get a call or two here first. Robert in North Hero Island, Vermont. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Boy, I just was sitting on top of my lawnmower on a beautiful day here and just loving this show.
Oh, good.
Gospel has just been in and around my life. Somebody mentioned Aretha, Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, the Staple Singers, all these people that ended up in sort of the rockabilly world came from. But a story that I was talking about a moment ago to your person just galvanized my interest in the 60s. I was about 25 years old, and I was a retailer. And we'd sold, it was hard times, a tough time, lots of assassinations going on in that period. And a gentleman came in and asked me, he wanted to buy a rocking chair and put it in every one of the rooms of an apartment house. And I took this whole truckload out, very glad for the sale. Deal was I had to put them together. And so I had a whole day ahead of me, and they had apparently decided to build a swimming pool in the middle of this courtyard. But the equipment couldn't get in there because it was post-construction.
And you were saying so this is in Dallas, Texas, Robert?
In Dallas, Texas,
okay.
In 1968. Not exactly ancient history.
No, but...
And there was a gang of black men, about 20 men, no power tools, just pickaxes and shovels. And they all had their shirts off. It was about 100 degrees hotter than hell. And I was going from apartment to apartment assembling these rocking chairs. But they began singing early in the morning on just an amazing day of song, all gospel, 8 hours of it.
Wow.
Didn't repeat the songs, constant, as you say, a leader calling out and then repeating back. And it just...
And swinging those picks in the sun in Dallas in 1968. As you say, this wasn't 1868 or 1768.
You're right. It was very, I mean, you know, the hot Camaro was on the road in 1968. But this was going, just harking back, and they lessened a really awful job in the heat with music. It was just, I'll never forget it.
Robert, you make it very real to us, and I really appreciate that story. That's an image that we will remember. Maybe somebody's swimming in that pool right now. Let's hear a little bit as we think about it, talk about it. This is James Cleveland. Deep down in my heart, I used to travel from town to town, training different church choirs to sing with him. He would bring his Savoy Records truck right up to the church.
Deep down in my heart.
Deep
down in my heart.
Well, it's deep, real deep.
James Cleveland and Deep Down in My Heart from the new documentary Rejoice and Shout. Crystal in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Crystal. You're on the air. Hello, Crystal. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes. What's your story, Crystal?
Well, I'm a PK, which is a preacher's kid.
Okay.
Grew up in Lexington, Kentucky. My father pastored a small church in Frankfort, Kentucky, Greenhill Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up listening to Mahalia Jackson, the Caravans, and all of those groups. And my mother had just about all of Mahalia's albums. And my great-grandmother used to come to the house just about every day, sit, listen to those albums, take a nip or two, and shout just like she was in church.
And how about you, Crystal? Are you tempted to do the same once in a while, or is that the past now?
No, I'm not tempted to do the same, but I still love listening to those old songs.
Oh, that's a great song. Great story. She'd be there just as if she were in church. Thank you for calling, Crystal, the PK,
all right, thank you.
PK in Lexington. I'm going to go right now, if I may, Bill and Joe, to New York City. And Sylvia Kennard joins us there, Baptist minister at the Christalis Center in Brooklyn, New York. She's also a gospel singer and practicing attorney. Sylvia Kennard, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you, Tom. How are you?
Oh, great. How's gospel music doing? Is it alive and well? You're out there in the practicing world. What do you say?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think I want to congratulate Joe on his documentary, but I think what he captures really eloquently is the evolution of gospel, that it continues to grow and change with the culture. He mentioned Azusa Street, which I thought was fitting because really the whole Azusa Street movement was really about the whole Pentecostal movement and this whole very vibrancy of the Spirit and people praising in a very loud way and very boisterous way and just being very free. And that in turn informed the music. But this is ebb and flow with the culture. I mean, Johns, who was the preacher who took Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery before Martin Luther King had it, his church didn't even allow him to use an organ because they thought that was a little bit too forward and too worldly, you know. So you think about these changes in the music, but it's definitely very much still alive and vibrant and a strong part of the worship experience.
And Sylvia, what about the kind of ecstatic end of it in the Pentecostal tradition? Bill Carpenter was saying earlier, I don't know if you heard him, but saying, you know, when we look at this great archival footage and we see people singing and then just literally collapsing in kind of a religious ecstasy or musical ecstasy. And
being slain in the spirit. That's the phraseology. They call it being slain in the spirit.
Yes, and I understand. And Bill was tying that back to the extraordinarily difficult lives many African Americans lived. Let's say if you look back to footage from the 30s or 40s. What about today? Do you still have that kind of slain in the spirit experience tied to gospel, or not so much?
I think it's changed a little bit. I think you still have that element. Very much so in terms of the whole charismatic movement of laying on of hands, speaking in tongues, being anointed with oil. There's still very much that. But then there's also the element, and you had just played Kirk Franklin's I Smile. There's also an attempt in gospel music to reflect the culture and to be relevant to the culture and to speak to the culture. So you'll see a lot more in terms of crossover music.
What do you think of that, Sylvia, as somebody who does it yourself? I mean, I listen to that Kirk Franklin, and yes, you can hear the gospel root there, but there's a lot of pop R&B going on there as well. What do you think of it?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some songs that you can't tell the difference with Kirk Franklin and Kanye West. I mean, he raps. He talks very much about the social condition of people. And so I think there's some element in the churches that have a problem with that. Like I said, I was talking about Vernon Johns and his relationship with Dexter Avenue Baptist Church back in the 30s. And they had a big problem with even using the organ. So there's always been this tension between being relevant to the culture, but also being a little bit separate, which the church is called to do as followers of Jesus Christ, to be in the world, but not of the world. So there's this tension even in the music.
And this gospel music has pushed out so far into the world that it meets all that world. You mentioned Kanye West. Here he is with his big song, Jesus Walks.
Yeah. Jesus talk to me. Oh, Jesus, Jesus talk to me. Jesus, Jesus. Oh, Jesus, Jesus.
Come on. God showed me the way. Now the devil can't break me down.
Jesus.
Open your eyes, the smoke in the sky.
Kanye West there. Bill Carpenter, all right. Do these intersect, or are these different tracks in the universe here? The gospel legacy, and, you know, there's Kanye very recently.
Right. I think there is a connection. And when Kanye West released that song, it was actually nominated for a Stellar Award initially, until the gospel community got upset and said, how can you let this guy who has profanity on this song about God be nominated for a Stellar Award, and he's not even a gospel rapper, and gospel rappers don't get the opportunity to do the things that he does.
Mm-hmm.
So they withdrew it. But it's all connected. I mean, I think there's no music that, like, if you look at modern day people like Richard Smallwood, he has bits of classical in his music. If you listen to Kirk Franklin, he's got a little bit of Parliament Funkadelic, and then mm-hmm. Parliament Funkadelic might have a little James Brown, and then James Brown has a bit of the Pentecostal from the early days, you know, the Azusa Street remnants that were down in South Carolina where he was living at the time, and the whole Church of God, United House of Prayer mm-hmm. Church, all that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's definitely connected.
I've got a little bit here from Smokey Robinson, who makes a very important appearance in Rejoice and Shout, talking about this tradition. Here he is on new strains of music and how they interact with the sort of maybe secular sound, maybe, but also with the vine, as Smokey Robinson sees it.
If an old person hears some kids rapping to God and it offends them, too bad, buddy. Because these kids are praising the Lord, and that's how they do it.
Smokey Robinson laying it down. Let's get a call from South Carolina. Queen is calling from Florence. Queen, thanks so much for calling. You're on the air.
You're quite welcome. I have been in gospel music all of my life. I'm 64 years old, and I've been playing since I was three. So I've been.
You sound about 23,
life.
Queen. You got a wonderfully young voice.
No, baby, no. My children are even older than that.
Okay.
But what I was saying when I listened, and I was turning through the stations this morning, and I found your show. And I first of all, I want to commend you on doing this, because one thing that I have been doing since I have been in the music world, I have various churches where I go to play. I try to educate people on the difference between gospel and contemporary music. When being as and my age and starting when I did, gospel is what I cut my teeth on.
Mm-hmm.
That gospel was how I learned, and that was all I did. And then when Oh Happy Day came out.
Yeah.
It was a turning point in the 60s for the change from gospel to contemporary music. And I was playing for a youth choir in Norristown, Pennsylvania, at my home church in Mount Zion.
Yes.
And one of the things they told me, Miss Queen, we have to sing the music that's coming out now. So I had to change my venue, if you would, from the classic James Cleveland,
yep.
the things that I really grew up on and really knew from my heart.
So how do you feel about that? How did you feel about that, or how do you feel about it now, Queen? Is something gained,
rebellious.
Something lost?
I was rebellious,
mm-hmm.
very rebellious,
mm-hmm.
because I felt that it was not of the Lord. I felt that it was like something totally foreign, and it was not part of the music world. It shouldn't be in the culture. However, what has happened, my second son told me, Mom, you need to listen to the words. Don't listen to the beat. Listen to the words. And when I began to listen to the words and began to hear what was being done, it was the same song, the same words, just with a beat and a rhythm, a change of rhythm, which changed from the gospel to the hard gospel. The Dixie Hummingbirds, the mm-hmm. James Cleveland style, the mm-hmm. Mahalia Jackson style, to the Kirk Franklins, to the all, you know, to all these new artists that are coming in here, Mary, you know, these are all things that have changed, and it's just growth and development.
And you think it carries the same capacity for the sacred, Queen?
It carries the same capacity, but it draws more youth. Whereas my generation, we are kind of on the threshold type thing. So a lot of us still gravitate toward the old style, but yet and still when you hear some of the new music, it still stirs your spirit. Now, as far as being slain in the spirit, like the lady a couple mm-hmm. calls before me mm-hmm. was saying, you do not see that as much now, because I play now in a Baptist church, and you do not see people being slain in the spirit so much. I don't know whether it's because people now have gotten so dignified that they no longer feel that they need to fall out on the floor and just praise the Lord and worship in that manner. But I don't know if that's what it is, or just a change of venue. I really don't know. But one thing, you'll see people quietly sit and cry. And when when they're doing praise dancing and they're doing like to the contemporary music, mm-hmm. It stirs your spirit more when you watch them and interpret as far as and the praise dance.
Queen, I appreciate our time is running out right here, and I so appreciate your call. What do you think, Sylvia? Is gospel going to roll on here, or does it get just blended in and at some point lost in new waves of contemporary music? We've just got half a minute, Sylvia.
I think that the important thing for all gospel artists to recognize is the rejoice and shout part of it, and that gospel means it is about something. There is a message in the music. And as long as that message doesn't get lost, and that's the message of God's love for mankind, that there's redemption and there's forgiveness for people, and that there's an opportunity for a second chance in Jesus Christ, that's the message of the music. And so whatever form it takes, drums, organs, it doesn't matter as long as the message remains. And I think it's going to continue to evolve.
Well, and I guess a lot of people are going to feel joy even right beyond that message. But Sylvia Kennard, we so appreciate you being with us today from Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining us. Bill Carpenter, you're wonderful. Uncloudy Days, the Gospel Music Encyclopedia is Bill's. Bill, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Joe Laurel, you have done a masterful piece of work here. Congratulations, sir, on Rejoice and Shout, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us. And again, the main thing we wanted to do was show the history of it so people don't forget these great artists.
It's all over this great footage and the music. Thank you for joining us. A list of where it plays around the country at our website. We'll go out with the Blind Boys of Alabama. Something Got a Hold of Me. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.